From Rochester, New York, this is Mad Dog Movies, episode 10.
Conversation between filmmakers Mike Boas and John Vincent, already in progress.
Speaking of monster movies.
Arg.
I went to see Hellboy 2 over the weekend.
I saw it on the opening weekend.
Yeah. And we had recently seen the Hellboy director's cut. I had the DVD and lent it to you. How do you think it stacked up to the first movie?
Pacing, I thought it was better. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it visually better. Mm-hmm. I liked them both. I really like his style of directing,
Guillermo del Toro.
Del Toro's direction style for this type of movie.
Yeah.
It's visual from the word go. And yeah, he brings his bizarro visual sensibilities to it, which I really kind of connect with.
Yeah, I thought the first one was a little uneven because they had all this character building to do that would somehow sort of push the plot. Like, we're going to go away from the plot for a while, which, you know, as a TV, if it was a TV show, you could get away with. In a movie, it was a little, you know, a little shaky. And I think this one, all the character moments actually really tied into the plot a lot better because they gave a love story to Abe Sapien, and that was
important. Well, it moved right along. It started at a good pace and ended at, you know, went through at a good pace, and it went by relatively quick, and it was a fairly long movie, I think.
Yeah, it was. Gee, I think it was about 110 minutes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was, you know, so I enjoyed it. It's very seldom do I come out of the movies these days where I really not only enjoy a film, but most of the time I come out saying, man, why did I waste my money on that? And that's a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if it's because I'm jaded because I've picked apart movies ever since I can remember and I've seen so many of them. I've worked on them that unless something's really, really spectacular, and I'm not talking special effects, I'm talking story and direction.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when I come out and I enjoy a film like Hellboy, it's nice.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what's great is Guillermo del Toro has been, for the last like 5-6 years or so, the fanboy community has sort of grabbed onto him and said, wow, we really like what this guy's doing. And Hellboy was kind of an okay hit. It did a lot better, I think, on video than it did in the theaters.
Yeah, I think it came to life long after its theatrical release.
So it was really cool. They were
kind of like Blade Runner.
It was really hard to get made, first of all, because Ron Perlman is not a lead actor. They wanted Ron Perlman. The name Hellboy doesn't go over well in certain communities where the word hell is a bad word. And just some of the weird concepts. Does he have to, suits would say, does he have to be red all the time? Does he have to have a tail? Does he have to have horns? And can he be like the Hulk where he's normal sometimes? They're like, well, we want to make it like the comic. And Del Toro had enough clout to bring on Mike Mignola from the comic and really make it half his.
Well, movie. How did he, I'm trying to think, he did Kronos.
Right.
He did Devil's Backbone. He did.
Well, Kronos led to, I think, his first studio picture, which was Mimic.
Mimic, that's right. I forgot he did Mimic.
Blade 2 and Devil's Backbone,
that's
like back to back, which was like yin and yang. You know, one is very arty and creepy and weird in Spanish, and one.
And of course, Pan's Labyrinth after Hellboy.
By the time he got to, then Hellboy, and then by the time he did Pan's Labyrinth, suddenly the two had sort of merged. He did a Spanish art film that's about fantasy and children and war and these important themes that also hit and resonated with audiences, despite the fact that it was a foreign language film, which is very tough. So by the time Hellboy 2 comes along, they're able to sell Hellboy 2, a mainstream action movie, right? For, for the kid and all of us. They're able to sell that on from the person that brought you Pan's Labyrinth, which was, something that at a different time and place wouldn't have gotten to as much of
an audience. And he's a very visual director.
Yeah.
And he comes from, and I've seen his drawings, and he designs and conceptualizes a lot of what you see on the film.
He does all the colors, too.
He does all the colors, and so he kind of jumps between directing and production designing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people do that. I mean, Robert Rodriguez, for God's sakes, unless you just stick his name up there. And no one else is, because it was everything he did. He's director of photography. He does the music. He does the directing, the writing, the production design, the sound design. Mm-hmm. It goes on. And that's a little much,
as far as I'm
concerned.
I think he stretched himself a bit thin with the computer animation in a couple of his movies, but
yeah, well, because he owns a company that does it, so he puts his name on there, you know.
Well, what Del Toro did with this one, though, is the first Hellboy that he had the story of, it's sort of a satanic Lovecraft.
Very Lovecraft.
A cult story, which I liked a lot.
Yeah.
Even though you have to watch it a few times to like.
They really use the Lovecraft mythology.
Yeah. I mean, you got gods from outer space who are awakened. And
someone's trying to bring them back into this world.
And
sounds familiar. This is where we reference our film.
But with this one, they said, okay, we've established the characters. Let's do something a little different with it. And it's almost like he had all these other fairy tale ideas from Pan's Labyrinth and went with this fairy tale world. It's almost like Harry Potter. The average person doesn't know that these fairy tales are real, but you go under a bridge and you hit a secret door and you get into their world. And boy, that was like, my eyes popped out. It was like the Star Wars cantina times 10.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to keep track of all the monsters in this one scene in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
Really, really stunning.
Maybe it's the cold wind that chills you to the bone, or the strange rumbling beneath the city streets. It's the unnerving sense that there's a world around us we cannot see. It's not your imagination.
And his designs are a little bit different.
Yeah. Yeah, things you haven't seen before. Characters without eyes,
you know,
and eyes in the wrong place.
Some people, like H.R. Giger, they brought him because he wasn't a production designer. They brought him to do, of course, Alien, and we all know what happened with that.
Yeah.
Patrick Tatopoulos has done some interesting things. I don't like everything he's done, but he's someone that bring a very visual, interesting
look. I loved his creatures in Pitch Black.
I did, too. There's a lot of things that he does that I do like. Was not happy with the Godzilla.
Yeah.
It reminded me of a Walt Disney character. The Godzilla had a big fat chin, just like Shere Khan, the tiger.
Oh, okay.
You know,
or Pete's dragon.
Pete's dragon. But he's someone that can bring some interesting stuff to a movie too. That was something different that you don't, you know, your typical design and production.
Yeah, yeah. What struck me about another thing about Hellboy 2 is not just that it's a fairy tale story, but that it's an ecological story. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of movies in the last year I've noticed. The basic thing is that humans are not treating nature correctly, and the elves in the story, you know, they want to regain control of the planet because things are going wrong. And there's this green monster creature in Hellboy 2 that is very much a sad giant of like a bygone age of like a tree spirit.
Right.
And it's the most beautiful thing when they put him down, but it's a sad, sad thing. Like an extinction of a species.
Mm-hmm.
Some other eco-horror things I've seen recently, The Happening has a very ecological bent to it.
Not a huge fan of
that's a really...
M. Night.
I didn't think it was a terrible movie, but I didn't think it was really good either. It was kind of in the middle. I don't hate Shyamalan like other people. I think in terms of technique, he has this classical technique that it's, you know, where he puts the camera and how he moves and the lighting and the shots and reveals of what's inside the frame and outside the frame. Very classical, well done, very Hitchcockian.
I would call it competent.
Competent. That's it. But he's so much more competent than everyone else.
That's true.
Out.
But
like,
that's
wow,
true.
Look, this guy knows what.
But there's a lot of crap.
Yeah.
So what happens is mediocrity rises to the surface.
Which is why I give him a chance.
But I'm jaded.
Yeah.
I'm jaded.
What else? Another Ron Perlman film from Larry Fessenden, came out on DVD. The Last Winter is the name of it. And Larry Fessenden did Wendigo.
Wendigo, yeah, which I liked that movie quite a bit, actually.
That was sort of an ecological horror.
About
spirits in the forest and last winter is
real
about
creepy. Another Rochesterian worked on that film.
Oh yeah,
Scott Levy.
Okay, yeah, right. Now out of New York.
Yeah, he has Eastern Effects. He has a grip and lighting house out of New York.
Yep, and Fessenden did this last winter, and you know he tried to defy really what your expectations are. You think you're going in, it's going to be like The Thing. There's going to be a monster, and it takes place in Alaska. And, you know, it doesn't quite go the way you think it's going to as a horror slasher. And it's more about what are we doing to mine the oil out of the earth? There have been a couple other Wall-E.
I remember the original not the original, but I remember one of the earliest ones was The Prophecy. You remember that one? The bear.
And the Indians and teepees and the Adirondacks or something. It was like totally...
And yeah, I forgot where it takes place.
Directed by your pal of mine, Frankenheimer.
Oh, Frankenheimer, that's right.
I love Frankenheimer films. Some of them were fantastic.
That he did that
some
one.
Of them are just like, what's going on there?
What we want? That's
he would
a
do
lot,
a lot of his work for hire, and that was kind of one of them. But you know, always interesting.
They go in cycles, the environmental horror films.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, Toxic Avenger.
Well, horror movies sort of reflect the time that you're in. Yeah. And it doesn't always, like, you know, some of them are really obvious if it's about 9/11 or about, the torture movies in the last few years are because really we're seeing images like that and we don't quite know what to do with it, and it bubbles up in horror movies. Back in the 20s, a lot of Todd Browning movies and Lon Chaney movies about missing limbs and freaks. They were kind of sort of a fear after World War I. People were coming home.
Because
surgery was at such a good point at that point. People wouldn't just die of a missing arm. They could come home with a missing arm. And there was all this castration anxiety because of it.
Well, it was an expressionistic art.
Well, German expressionism, too.
Yeah, I read out of World War I.
Yeah.
Because of all the experiences that the people had,
So, and sometimes you can't really recognize it while you're watching it. And it takes 10 years to go by and say, oh, wow, you know, what was that trend all about? And maybe that had something to do with, you know, maybe slashers had something to do with the politics of the time or all the religious stuff in the 70s, The Omen and Exorcist had something to do with Vietnam and losing belief in things. You hear theories of it, and that's all it is theories.
You know, I think the slasher films really started coming in when there was nothing going on.
Yeah.
There was no really major wars or conflicts during the 80s because they started when I was in high school.
Yeah.
Pretty much, or grammar school, or not grammar school, but 79 is when they really started kicking in.
Well, was it also sort of an extension of, you know, late 60s, early 70s,
the MPAA codes
came in. So things got gorier and gorier, and then by the time
our buddy Herschel Gordon Lewis is, you know, responsible for some of that early
and by the time you get to Friday the 13th and movies like that, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a cartoon. How can we kill people next?
Right.
So maybe it isn't that political, but people, I've read essays from people that analyze these things. And I think with controversy over what are we doing to the planet, or is it, you know, is global warming real or something we're responsible for? I think it's
some place in between, which is what I feel.
It's coming out in our movies. I mean, not just horror, but I was saying WALL-E, the animated film. It's about what happens at the end of the world when there's only a robot left to pick up the planet and can we reclaim the Earth?
I haven't seen it yet.
Something. You will believe a robot can cry. So that's Hellboy 2.
All right.
Well, it's nighttime and you're with an audience. And the lights go down, and you go into a world. And at some point in the 60s, people became cynical and ironic. Midnight movies were the opening wedge in the birth of irony.
The very fact that it was playing at midnight was almost a brand name. It was a genre. It sounded forbidden, a midnight movie.
It doesn't lie. Write a script, get a crew, do it.
It's all an experiment.
A B-movie, horror, and sci-fi.
One cinema, one little line, midnight.
John, you were asking me earlier about...
I don't think I was.
Okay. How do you want to start this midnight movie talk?
Well, I mean, it got me thinking about midnight movies. Was some time ago you had let me borrow a disc that Stars Network, I think, put out, and they did a documentary.
It's a documentary called Midnight Movies from the Margin to the Mainstream, and it was from the same documentary filmmaker who did Visions of Light many years ago, great doc on cinematography.
Right, which I have that on my Netflix queue.
Oh, I'm thinking of buying it sometime because it's such a... That's the movie that made me realize what cinematography like really was. And anyway, so the Midnight Movies doc. I had a screener copy of it from Starz Networks, and it played at the High Falls Film Festival too later that year.
I didn't realize it played at the festival.
It really sort of breaks down this magical time from about 72, 73. Through 1980, 81, somewhere around there, when you could have a movie have a non-traditional distribution where, okay, you've got your Disney movie in 1,000 theaters during the daytime, but what are the potheads going to go to at midnight in New York and LA?
And there was no video, right. Home video, and there was...
That's what killed it, really.
You know, so people would go out. I mean, before there was cable television.
Mm-hmm.
Before there was any of that stuff, and they would have midnight movies.
You want to have an experience. You want to have a party. It's more like they'd sell it like a rock show more than than just a movie. It's an experience. You go out and you see Night of the Living Dead with 300 other people who, wow, this is amazing.
Right. Or the Harder They Come.
Harder They Come out of Jamaica, right?
Was Jimmy Cliff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the
John Waters.
In the movie, they covered a few of these Pink Flamingos,
mm-hmm.
El Topo.
I still haven't seen El Topo.
It's a hard watch, man.
Is it? Yeah.
I liked Holy Mountain a lot better. Chock full of things that are designed to offend your eyes,
mm-hmm.
and sort of mess with your head. But Holy Mountain is actually, I think, holds together. What else did they cover? Eraserhead.
Eraserhead, which was, I saw that not at a midnight movie, but I did see it. They screened it at the RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology. They
had a late night crowd.
College crowd, and I thought it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I did. I mean, it's kind of bizarro. There's absolutely no linear structure. Hello, surprise, mm-hmm. from David Lynch. So I enjoyed that, and Rocky Horror I was not a big fan of.
Yeah.
I did go to it because I was dating a girl that was playing one of the parts in the audience, so.
Yeah.
I did go to that, and it was worth it.
What's interesting is that each of those was done outside of the mainstream, except for Rocky Horror, was a studio picture.
Right, and that took a long time to catch on, and the only reason it caught on was because of the midnight movie.
Yeah, and it failed as a studio picture.
It failed horribly.
It said, hey, let's try the midnight movie circuit.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. played for decades, and it probably still is in some places. Not playing here right now.
I hope not.
But I went out and saw, I had friends in college who were into Rocky Horror, so I was into it briefly.
Never quite got it, that whole concept. I understood the whole midnight movie thing.
The last time I saw Rocky Horror, I didn't get into it as much as far as making fun of the movie, because I had listened to the soundtrack a few times and seen it on cable a few more times, and I actually respect the movie too much to make fun of it now. But it's a cheesy movie. But.
One of Susan Sarandon's early pictures.
Yes. Well, I love Tim Curry too. So.
Tim Curry, of course, yeah.
So what, you got El Topo, which was a Mexican movie made for almost no money,
mm-hmm.
but it was very strange, and I think John Lennon endorsed it.
After it ran at the Elgin.
Yeah, they picked it up for like regular distribution.
And it bombed.
And it bombed, yeah.
Yeah.
You got John Waters doing his own thing out of Baltimore.
Oh, God. I love John Waters. I mean, some of his movies are hard to watch. Technically, very inferior.
But I
love his movies. I just love the... In fact, one of my favorite Simpsons, if not my favorite Simpson episode...
That was great.
...is when John Waters was on there.
Yeah.
Still laughing. I laugh about it, just thinking about it.
But John, he had this sort of weird group of friends, and they were all into fashion and punk scene and just...
Had no clue what to do with the camera.
Right.
At all.
Right. They were working from an art point of view, uh-huh. not a filmmaking point of view, but somehow it worked.
It works. It's great. I mean, it's not for everybody, but I'm not, what was on not that long ago, and I watched it, Polyester.
Right. Oh, that's... With the scratch and sniff cards, I watched that on Comedy Channel once.
Yeah,
and you can get a scratch and sniff from the TV guide.
Divine, he or she, whatever you want to call her. I thought was fantastic, in those roles. I really did.
It's all about chewing the scenery and being as obnoxious as possible. But what's great is, the tide is turned and you can't shock people like you can anymore.
No, I know
He's
it.
He's mainstream now.
He's become,
got a new musical, Crybaby is going to be on Broadway, or maybe it already is, based on the Crybaby movie.
Uh-huh.
And, you've got lyrics in there about teen pregnancy and all sorts of...
All these taboo things that he did. I mean, people are doing it on a regular basis. Now you can't watch Family Guy without seeing stuff that John Waters had done back in the 70s.
Yeah.
midnight movies had to be funny and or shocking in a surprising way, something completely new that you hadn't seen before. Mainstream society hated these movies and was against everything they believed in. Now, that's radically different today. Everything that was in midnight movies is in Hollywood movies. Everything that midnight movies offered has become American humor.
And at the, really, in the time, it was really heavy-duty taboo stuff.
Right, well.
It wasn't pornography, but it wasn't far off in the eyes of a lot of
that
people.
No one ever sees, you know. I mean, he had nudity, male nudity that you wouldn't see, and really, you know.
Divine eats a dog turd.
Dog turd, which is...
A real dog turd.
That's enough for me not to see the movie. I've never seen it.
I know. Really. No, thank you. Yeah.
I saw Female Trouble. I saw Polyester. And I'm like, I don't really want to go back to Pink Flamingos. I think I can. I know what I'd be in for. But I respect the guy. And he is so well-spoken and funny. And
oh, he's a Ryan. I love him, yeah.
And he'll break down pop culture like no one else. I've heard he gives great commentaries on DVDs that aren't even his. And I haven't.
We should try to get him on the podcast.
That'd be great. So he'd shoot, you know, really cheap movie, send it off to the distributor. It's like, wow, I don't know what the heck this is. I had to back up the reel and say, did I just see what I thought I saw? But I can't take it, but send me the next one. And eventually Pink Flamingos was it. Night of the Living Dead, which was made in 68, but they couldn't do anything with it at that time. And, you know, that same weekend was the weekend Martin Luther King was shot when they were just trying to deliver it to their distributor.
And in the film, the lead character is a black man that gets shot.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't until maybe 71 or later that made it big on the midnight movies. And, yeah, it's definitely a film about what it's like to be an outsider.
And that one, I think, probably was technically – well, I think it was probably the best film – as a whole, I think, out of all the other, for me,
yeah,
it was a whole movie. It was very well done story.
I mean, you could
structure.
Say Eraserhead is totally
Eraserhead has no. Night of the Living Dead was a mainstream, could have been considered a mainstream with a lot of more violence than you would normally have,
right.
And with the underlying social commentary that he had. You watch a David Lynch film, and it's just like, you know, looking at a Pollock painting.
Yeah, it's not something that is the subject of the film is the film itself.
So
you just go on the dream trip along with it and hang
as long
on.
as long as you can hold on.
Yeah,
right.
Boy, that little baby thing. Oh, it geez. Just creeped me out so much. I haven't been able to watch a movie a second time. So what does that mean for today? I mean,
you know, my thought is, and I could be wrong, but people are so saturated with the tiny screens with the that I'm wondering if it is the right time to start bringing back these midnight movies and these special screens to get people out of their house. I mean, I'm fatigued with the home theater experience.
Are people too locked into their suburban?
Well, that could be.
Shelves.
That could be. But I don't know. It's just a thought. You know, it's just a feeling on my part that it may be a good time to start trying to get people out of their houses and getting it back into the social experience of watching a film like this, not your just theatrical film you go to your multiplex for. So we're working on that. We're going to see if we can make it fly here in Rochester at a local theater.
Yeah, I know that other screenings I've been to in Rochester that have more of a cult appeal, like Blade Runner or Evil Dead, when they screen locally, they draw.
They draw huge. I mean, Return of the Living Dead is packed.
These are movies that already do have a cult following on video, and people want to go and see them in the crowd. So, so to do a successful midnight movie, can you do it with a movie no one's ever heard of, or does it have to?
No, I think we have to hit the movies that people already know.
Yeah.
At least at first.
Feast. Remember Feast?
Feast, and that was packed. That was it was packed.
Okay.
There was the full. Full house for Feast.
All right.
We saw that. That was like a late showing.
It was like one night or two nights.
One night with two showings or something like that. Yeah. And we'd like to hear from some people that might be listening to us to see what they would think, if they'd be interested in checking out this. And I'm thinking making it more of an experience than just, hey, this movie's showing, come and watch it. Talk about the movie at the beginning.
Have a discussion,
have a theme. For instance, we're thinking about doing Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead. You know, have people come dressed up as zombies and get a
zombie night
and have a barbecue.
Yeah.
You know, zombie barbecue there. You know, we can go in.
Oh, wow.
You know, that type of thing. So it's not just we're going to screen the movie. So I think
You're talking about maybe a host.
Yeah, maybe a host that, you know, that's there every night. It'd be a horror host or some kind of character. Just, you know, some, you know, kitschy thing that, you know, be entertaining. People can have fun with. Mm-hmm. Get them out, you know, into the social realm again.
I'm impressed with, I've been keeping track of things that are going on in Toronto. And there's the Trash Palace in Toronto. Which is a small, you know, it's a relatively small room. It's not a theater, but they, you know, fill it with chairs. They get their 60mm projector. They sell popcorn.
That's kind of feeling I like to get.
And maybe they have as many as 30 people, and they watch a weird movie.
Right. You know, that's what I would like to convey somehow. If someone gets some advertising,
I think I'd like to go a little bigger with some, you know, movie that already has.
Well,
no.
Right, with a movie, but the sense where you get a bunch of people to come over to watch a film at your house, and you get all excited, and there's like, you know, oh wow, we're gonna watch Dawn of the Dead or whatever movie it is, mm-hmm. and we're gonna try to convey that feeling with the light screenings. In fact, we might even have. You know, the special features before the movies, you know, and
if we have short films,
you know, short films that local people, if we, like, for instance, if we have a theme, if we do a zombie picture, maybe we'll have our local filmmakers make 5-minute zombie pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the best two or three we'd screen before the movie, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. It'd be fun to promote. In terms of...
We'll probably have something on the podcast, specifics about what we're planning
to
do.
Yeah, if we nail down the details, we can announce it here. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
Right.
But, you know, I'm interested in Ballyhoo and it would be a fun thing to try and promote in terms of local news or getting on the radio or TV or internet.
So, people listening, let us know what you think about the idea.
My boss over at Animatus, Fred Armstrong, he once promoted a book from a friend of his. By dressing up as a werewolf and going to book signings as a werewolf.
Yeah, I remember that. But Derek did the makeup for that.
Oh, okay. Jeez. Yeah. I didn't... It makes sense.
Yeah.
But I've seen pictures from it, and it was like a great gimmick. I mean, and of course, he's got the personality to carry it off, too.
He's got a personality, all right.
But, you know, acting like a wolfman and running around and biting people and whatever. I don't think I could pull it off, but, you know, I'd like to see you in some makeup sometime.
Yeah. I bet. And probably a dress and some high heels, right?
Fred was also, he dressed up as Divine one time recently.
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah.
It was we'll have to post a picture up on the website. Oh, my God.
So Freddie dressed up as Divine for, it was a fundraiser for the High Falls Film Festival, and it was Come As Your Favorite Hollywood Personality. And
For Jack Garner, our resident film critic.
He was retiring from his job at the paper. And Fred has had a beard for probably 20, 30 years, I don't even know, and he shaved his beard just for this.
I don't ever think I saw him without a beard, I've known him for a long time.
No one knew who he was. He's this big guy in a gold lamé dress and the blue eyeshadow and the lips. Oh, the lips really made it.
Oh, God.
Had that downturned Divine, you know, lipstick, you know, and the wig. And he'd come running up to you when you come into the room.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I just got there. I don't even know. And, he's coming right at me. And, you know, he's doing this big gay thing. And he throws his arms around you. He did that to like 100 people. And no one who knew who he was until someone, oh, it's Fred. And they freaked out.
You know? It was funny. It was one of the funniest things I think I've seen. So,
I will never get him to do it again, but he'd be a great one to like help promote. If we got a John Waters film, get him to do it again.
Oh, yeah. If he could do the Divine thing, that would be great. That would be real.
Get you.
Well, it would be great to do like Come As Divine.
Oh, my God.
We get the whole alternative lifestyle community to come in and see the movie.
Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah.
Home of the Image Out Film Festival here in Rochester. So, yeah.
Yeah, why not, you know? So that'd be fun.
So... I don't know, something to think about, and we're just sort of shooting out ideas. Maybe we'll get some feedback from other people in Rochester.
Listen, please write to us. We'd love to read your emails, and if you have any questions about anything that has to do with the movie business or anything at all, please email us, and we will, if we don't have the answers ourselves, we will get them for you. Anything from questions about certain films to technical questions on how to shoot, how to film, how to do audio, anything, you know, that you want to know, please ask us.
That email is feedback@maddogmovies.com. And you can check out show notes at maddogmovies.com/podcast. And that'll wrap it up for this episode.
Ta-ta.
Music for this episode was provided by Keith Handy.